Okay, so we are in the midst. I'm actually not going to put the outline up that I put up every week. I'm going to break the streak, okay? It's okay. But we're in the central hub of this book, where he's developing the idea that Jesus is the perfect and greatest high priest. And beginning in last week's text in chapter 8, he almost pauses to summarize the main, in fact, he says it that way, doesn't he? This is the main point that we have made so far. And so the writer speaks to that in chapter 8. And once again, we dance the dance with this clicker, okay? So Jesus is indeed the minister of a better covenant. If there was going to be a change in priesthood to a greater priesthood, then of necessity there must be a change, a replacing of the covenant, inseparably linked to that priesthood. And so Jesus is not just a superior high priest, he is a minister in a superior covenant, a better covenant. He is a superior priest. In chapter 9, we're going to see some emphasis on the superior sanctuary. So he's a superior priest ministering in a superior place. It is a covenant that is built on superior promises. Of course, anybody who studied Hebrews very much at all is very used to that language. Superior, the synonym we most often use is the word better, and that is found in many translations. So, what makes the covenant better? Even the old covenant foretold of this coming new covenant in Jeremiah 31. We looked at that text. It is quoted. Half of Hebrews 8 is essentially a quotation of this text in Jeremiah 31, where the prophet spells out a number of ways in which this covenant would be superior. We won't go back through that. But now we switch our attention. Well, in this flow of thought, we now continue with this idea that Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant. And so at the end of chapter 8, we see God's promise through Jeremiah. In chapter 9, he's going to begin to get into a comparison of the two sanctuaries. If you read chapter 9, you notice the language of first and second. And so that you can decode that, when he talks about the first, he is talking about the earthly sanctuary, specifically the tabernacle. Of course, there were multiple iterations of that. Well, you had the tabernacle, and then what succeeded that? The temple, okay? But he speaks of it in terms of a tent, I think, in part, to emphasize that it was always designed to be temporary. He's going to speak in some detail, although he will say in the text, we can't speak about it in the detail we might like to. And so who am I not to follow suit when it comes to that? We'll highlight the things that the writer has said, but his point in speaking about even the details of the first sanctuary, we're going to see that God had a purpose in all of this, and that was to foreshadow the coming, the fact that there would be a superior high priest and that there would be a superior sanctuary. And so in chapter 9, we see those thoughts develop. Let's do some reading together in Hebrews chapter 9. Could I get a volunteer to read for us? We've got our runners back here. Verses 1 through 10 for us. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 1 through 10. Brother Leon, go ahead. I think that's Leon.
Now, even a first covenant had ordinance, the divine service, in its sanctuary, a sanctuary of this world. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the first, wherein were the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the holy place, and after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies. Having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was a golden pot holding the manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it, cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat, of which things we cannot now speak severally. Now these things having been thus prepared, the priests go in continually into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the services. But into the second, the high priest alone, once in the year, not without blood, which he offereth for himself and for the errors of the people, the Holy Spirit this signifying that the way into the holy place hath not yet been made manifest, while the first tabernacle is yet standing, which is a figure for the time present, according to which are offered both gifts and sacrifices that cannot, as touching the conscience, make the worshiper perfect.
Okay, I need to correct something I just said, okay? You're not going to be able to decode first and second if I've given you the wrong key, and I knew I would do this. When he talks about the first and second, both of those apply to the first sanctuary, okay? The earthly sanctuary. In the text, what is the first? What is the first part of the earthly sanctuary mentioned? I mean, the earthly sanctuary, the tabernacle, was divided up into two sections. The first one would be the holy place. The second one, by process of elimination, would be the most holy place. Let's see that in the text. I'm sorry for misspeaking earlier. In verse 2, for a tent was prepared, the first section, in which... what was in the first section of the earthly tabernacle? He identifies, I mean, if you've studied the earthly tabernacle at all, these, of course, are items that are familiar to us. The lampstand, in fact, several of you studied at least portions of this in your study of Leviticus and Numbers. You had the lampstand, you had the table, you had the bread of the presence. But then dividing the first section from the second section is the veil. And behind the second curtain, in other words, the entrance into the second, was a second section called the most holy place. Now here he identifies the golden altar of incense with... where was the golden altar of incense actually positioned? It was actually outside the veil, right? It was not... why does he include the golden altar of incense with the second section? Why is that connected with the second section? Go ahead.
Because its function was to fill the most holy place with incense and cloud that. If it had been in the most holy place, then the priest could not have entered it to burn the incense. So the reason it's, I think, in Hebrews is listed as being part of the most holy place, because in function, that's what it was associated with.
Okay, because of its function, it's inseparably linked with the second place. What specific day? Of course, there's also the offering of a sacrifice. What I'm thinking of is a specific day on the calendar. And he'll refer to this here in the text, where the priest takes blood, the high priest, once a year, takes blood into the most holy place. What day did that happen on? The Day of Atonement, in the seventh month. Okay. So that's his meaning of first and second. The first section is the holy place, the second section is the most holy place, verse 4, having the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna. He identifies the items that were inside the Ark of the Covenant. You had what? Three things. A golden urn holding the manna, which signified what? Why would manna have been preserved in an urn and placed inside the Ark of the Covenant? Okay, it is symbolic of God's provision, right? Of God sustaining them. Then you had Aaron's staff that budded. What was the significance of that? Okay, it was. I mean, there are, I suppose, different ways of saying this, but it's symbolic of God's choosing. Okay? And then you have, of course, the tables of the covenant. Because, of course, all of this is I mean, the covenant and the terms of the covenant are spelled out. You're sitting on the complete wrong side. You got me all down. That's okay. Sorry, I put you on the spot. I just turned, I was like, oh, it's the halls. You have the tables of the covenant, of course, the covenant, the priesthood and the ministering, those are all inseparably linked together, okay? So all of those things have obviously a symbolic connection to God. Of course, verse 5, above the ark were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Now, in fact, in the spirit of verse 5, let's don't get too far down into the weeds here, and let's go on and note some things, some highlights about verses 6 through 10, because I want us to see the larger point that the author is making. He says, these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second, only the high priest goes. Now, what is the second section symbolize? In fact, the previous verses point to this. The most holy place of all, which is tied to the presence of God. I think one of the themes of Hebrews chapter 9 is the theme of accessibility. Accessibility. Why is the new covenant better? Well, better for all of the reasons the book states. You have a better priesthood, you have a better sanctuary, a better sacrifice. But where the rubber meets the road for us is greater what? Accessibility to God. And that is something for us that is worth our thinking about and glorying in, the fact that as New Testament Christians, we have accessibility to God. Think of the picture of the tabernacle. How accessible. I mean, this very picture. I mean, we see the tabernacle depicted in artwork. We also see it just kind of in terms of a floor plan, right? You got the rectangles. You got the holy place and the most holy place. And the dimensions for that were all spelled out by God. He built everything according to the pattern. We had some discussion about that. But I want you to see the bigger picture. What is that picture, that earthly tabernacle? What picture does that give you about access when it comes to accessibility to God? Go ahead.
First of all, it only happens one time a year.
Okay.
The high priest that gets to go into the most holy can only go in there one time a year.
Okay. 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 Mark, you had a thought. Let's get a microphone over to Mark. It's one of the necessary evils we accept in this setting, because it's otherwise they'll never be able to hear you.
Okay. Close enough.
Yeah.
It gives me the image like a vault in a bank, and you don't just walk into the vault and grab your money. You got to go to the table where the cashier is, and you got to make the application, and then the right person goes back in the back, and then you got to put in the code, and they go inside. There's many layers of requirement.
Yeah.
You don't just walk, dance in, and approach God. It has to be done in a specialized way with specialized requirements.
Now, I want you to think about it. Thanks for your comment. I want you to think about what God's purpose would be, or purposes would be, for designing the first tabernacle that way. Why would he limit? I mean, think about that. Not every Israelite got to go into the first section. Who went into the first section? Yeah, I mean, just for starters, there was only one tribe of people. Yeah, it's all about lineage, right? It centers on lineage. The other 11 tribes had no access to the... I mean, there were areas that they could approach, but so you've got all of these layers of removal. There are degrees of separation from God. What could be one of God's purposes for setting things up that way? What would it teach about him? Dion, we got a mic coming.
For me, it reminds me of how God, when he says something or when he does something, how specific he is and how important his words are for us to follow. I think of Uzzah here, you know, reaching out and touching just, you know, part of the ark. And here's another example where specific rules and regulations are, and I don't know if that's the right term to use, but just the fact that what God says matters and how we need to follow it to the nth degree.
Yeah. I think all of this, and to combine the two points that were made here, I mean, why would God institute these degrees of separation to teach that, listen, one doesn't just get to haphazardly approach a holy God in this fashion. Shannon has a comment down here. Oh, you were ready. Okay, go ahead.
I think it's to remind us of God's nature of holiness, that he's holy, he's righteous, and he does not accept things that are unrighteous. And so at that point in time, you know, before Christ, sin is what separated us from God. And I think it was a reminder to the people that God distanced himself from sin and unrighteousness.
Okay, it was to teach people principles of holiness. It was to teach people principles about his heart. It's not that he wants to be distant from his creation. But because of the presence of sin, some dramatic things have to happen in order for fellowship to exist between God and his creation. Remember, the story of the Bible is answering the question, how can God's justice and his love both be perfectly satisfied? Of course, the cross of Jesus is going to be the answer to that. But in the earthly sanctuary, he is laying the foundation for all of that. In fact, notice verse 8. Did we have another comment? I'm sorry. Was someone else waiting? Okay. So in verse 6 again, to kind of run up to this, these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section. So that is what? Daily, weekly, monthly, right? There's at least some regular traffic through there. But then to Peggy's point, into the second, only the high priest goes, and how often? Once a year. I want you to think about that. One human being, one time a year, into the most holy place. Think about that. And of course, when he does so, I mean, imagine being the high priest. How would you feel about that responsibility? I mean, just to further emphasize, I think, the point that we're making here. If you're the high priest, how do you feel about this responsibility? You're about to go. I forget who mentioned the history. Maybe Deanna was you with Uzzah. Did you mention Uzzah? How might you be feeling? I'll just ask it that way. I guess I'm kind of revealing how I might be thinking if I were the high priest. It's kind of scary, isn't it? Very, you're going to enter into this fearfully. This is awesome, which I think was the point, right? But because he knows he's entering into the presence of God. What did Isaiah say when he saw the vision of God on his throne in Isaiah chapter 6? What was his immediate reaction? His instinct was to react how? I am a man of unclean lips. I promise any high priest worth his salt going into the most holy place, boy, he's going to make sure he has his I's dotted and his T's crossed. This is serious. And before he ever offers atonement for the people, there has to be blood shed on behalf of himself. He realizes all the procedures only underscore a reality that the high priest knew all too well. And that is, I am a sinner. And I'm about to enter into the presence of God. Now look at verse 8. By this, what's this? Forgive me, would I be asking for the antecedent here? I'm looking to my grammar expert over here. Because I am not that. What is this pointing to? I'll ask it that way. What does this point to? By this, would it not be the instructions about the Day of Atonement? And probably more broadly, all of the things that he spelled out here in verses 6 and 7. Who revealed all of that instruction? Who was involved in the revelation of that instruction? Just who we would expect would be involved in that revelation, the Holy Spirit. So that's what I think he's saying. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates, through all of this, that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. Now that word for symbolic, in verse 9 I highlighted. Does anybody know what Greek word, somebody might have this right? It is the Greek word for parable. Parabole. I cannot pronounce these words. I would rely on Curtis for all matters related to pronunciation of Bible terms. It is a parable. Could we plug that in? Which is a parable for the present age. What's he saying about, I mean, we could say the purpose there. It's a multifaceted, multi-purpose design here, the earthly sanctuary. And part of that multi-design purpose was to teach something about accessibility to God. And further, the transitory nature by design of that first sanctuary. I mean, could one look at the earthly sanctuary and think at all that this was God's end game? It doesn't accord with everything that we know about God to remain. God never willed to remain so distant from people, to have so many layers of removal from his creation. Yes, it was necessary for multiple reasons. But I think what the writer here is saying, whether I'm explaining it very well or not, is that all of this instruction is saying that accessibility to God is not the way God always intended for it to be as long as the first section is still standing. So what would that say about the first section? It's temporary. It's going to have to go away, that's the point he's been making. The covenant has to, I mean, at the end of chapter 8, whatever is becoming obsolete, he's speaking of the old covenant, and growing old is ready to vanish away. It was always intended to vanish away. The covenant was intended to vanish away. The purpose for all of it, once having been fulfilled, would fade away, would no longer be needed because the substance would be ushered in. And so that would apply to the covenant, that would apply to the sanctuary, that would certainly apply to the high priest, and it would also apply to the sacrifices. All of them were intended to serve as a copy or a shadow, to borrow from other language the writer has used, of greater things to come. And so verse 9, according to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed, now notice this language, until the time of reformation, That word until, again, emphasizes the temporary nature of what God instituted here under Moses. It will end at the select time. And then, of course, the word reformation points to a new order of things. And so, I'm a little behind on my slides here. To kind of summarize, he's highlighted some things about, well, I'm not going to go through this in detail. I'm just going to, I should have just had these all come up. That's essentially how the earthly tabernacle is designed. You have a holy place, a most holy place. In the holy place you have priests. Only the high priest could go into the most holy place. Regular offerings one day per year, always for self as well as for others. It's always the blood of animals and always for the purifying of the flesh. Okay? But then he's going to get into a comparison now between that earthly tabernacle and the heavenly sanctuary. So we'll go ahead and put these up here. I think they will be the same. Okay, and so now we pick up our reading in verse 11. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Could we get a volunteer to read verses 15 through 28? Let's just go ahead and have a fresh reading of the rest of the chapter. 15 through 28. I know that's a big ask. Aaron Morton over here. Thank you, Aaron. My VBS brother.
Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood, for when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats, with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." And in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entrusted not into the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as the high priest enters the holy places every year with blood not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for men to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. And so he's going to continue to develop this idea that, he's laid the foundation for it, but now he's going to complete the picture. All of the things that we saw in the earthly tabernacle were designed to foreshadow the coming of a greater covenant, a greater priesthood, ministering in a greater sanctuary. In what he describes as the good things that have come, verse 11, or in verse 10, the time of Reformation. When we look at the picture of the earthly sanctuary, we see that God purposely designed it to be insufficient. And when placed beside the greater sanctuary and the greater priesthood, that stark contrast becomes ever the more clear. And so, whereas there were priests who ministered in the earthly tabernacle, the writer is speaking of the greater sanctuary in the very presence of God, not in a small enclosure that signified the presence of God with physical elements, but into the very presence of God himself. And so instead of priests, instead of high priests, now you have Jesus, the Son, and high priest. Okay? He's already been developing this argument. But when you place side by side, there's just no comparison. Whereas you have regular offerings in the holy place, whereas you have one sacrifice per year for atonement, that too is temporary, right? How do you know? Because you have to do it again next year. With Jesus, you have once for all time. In fact, the text will say in verse 15 that a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Whereas you have Old Testament priests offering for themselves as well as for others, here we have a high priest, that's much better, that offers not with regard to his own sin, because he is sinless. He has fulfilled every requirement of the first covenant. Couldn't get it out. Thus fulfilling the requirement of that covenant, and thus rendering it obsolete. And so through his sacrifice, he fulfilled the old covenant, but also made sufficient sacrifice for all others. Instead of the blood of animals, of course, you have his own blood. And whereas clearly the Old Testament did have a particular focus on the flesh, here we have language that he'll repeat in chapter 10, where the conscience is purified. And so thus, the guilt of sin has been dealt with once for all. And he closes the chapter by noting that having now dealt with the guilt of sin, his next coming will be to deliver us from the power of death. Christ has died once. He came once and died, but he will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, he's done that, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. So that's kind of a bird's eye view of the rest of chapter 9. At this point, I'll ask, any comments? Does this change how you read the Old Testament? It should. Instead of getting bogged down in the weeds and the details, which that's perfectly fine to do when you're going through a book like Leviticus. It seems to be, I mean, the end of Exodus is very much the same. It's very, very difficult, very detail-oriented. But when we get down in the weeds on that, what is one thing we should always remember? The big picture. What is God doing with this? Any thoughts or comments about how this text helps your reading of the Bible, or just anything else that you want to offer? Michael?
Just curious, I was kind of thinking as we were going through about several passages that talk about Yahweh can't dwell in houses made by human hands. And then correspondingly, how we're shown in the New Testament specifically that God is going to dwell in us, in our hearts. You reckon that plays a part in a little bit of this new understanding of maybe the difference between the old covenant and the new?
Well, I do think those are all connected, right? Those are two completely different pictures, like we've said. And maybe the expression degrees of separation, that's just what I'm... You get locked into a certain phrase when you're up here teaching. There's probably a better one. But I'm thinking of distance. I'm thinking of accessibility. Whereas as now, Jesus remains in the presence of God, seated at the right hand of God, and always lives to make intercession for the saints. That is, in terms of accessibility, that's a huge step up. In terms of intimacy, that's a huge step up. Dion over here. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Curtis. In fact, I don't see Scott. There's a reason why. I need to expand my range of view. Go ahead, brother.
I think one of the things that's important for us to recognize in terms of the holiness of God is, as it says in verse 7 of the chapter, it says these sacrifices that were made, including the Day of Atonement, were made for sins of the people committed in ignorance. There's no provision in the Old Testament for sins of the high hand.
Yeah.
You know, a full out rebellion against God.
Right.
These are mistakes that people made that they recognized, even those needed to be made provision for. But one of the superior aspects of the new covenant is the fact that we can even be forgiven for previous rebellion.
You lay that beside Paul's language in 1 Timothy 1, where it's a classic Pauline triple, where he talks about, I forget the three expressions, but he talks about his manner and disposition toward the cause of Christ before being encountered by the Lord. He was an insolent opponent, the New American Standard says. That's not an unintentional sin. That is intentional, that is premeditated, that is deliberate. There was a venom toward the cause, toward the way, that ran through Paul's veins. And yes, another way of accentuating or highlighting the stark contrast between the old covenant and the new. Both are good. They both come from God, but both of them have a purpose. And one was designed to be much, much greater. Dion?
Yeah, I don't know if I know how to say this right, but one of the things that really amazes me through all this is how the Creator became the creation. Like, He created Himself as part of His creation. And I only say that because when you go back and look at, you know, God speaking everything in existence, the level and the extent that He's gone to reach us, but on His terms.
Yes.
And with His words.
Well, I think you touch on something there that the writer has dealt with multiple times, early in the letter and then also here. Some might look at the incarnation of Christ and certainly the death of Christ as a mark of inferiority. What kind of a Savior is a dying Savior? Well, the gospel explains how that's the case. Why did Jesus have to die in chapter 2 to be made like His brethren? Here, His death was necessary for the inauguration of this new covenant, and He gets into that in some detail. Yes?
You were asking a question about does this help us when we now look back at the Old Testament? And for a Gentile that lives on this side of the cross, the Old Testament doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and Hebrews puts it together. Because now I look back and see what God was doing. I sort of understand the purpose of it. I see the shadows, which I would have never figured that out on my own. If I didn't have a book like this to kind of point to things, I would have been going, well, this is really weird. Why is God doing all of these things? Well, now when I read the Old Testament, I can understand it. I can say, okay, now I see what really God was meaning in all of this. And it tells me a lot about how fortunate I am to live on this side of the cross.
Yeah. Yes, as a function of the time in which we grew up and the heritage that we have, can just by virtue of our placement on the timeline. I mean, there are other peoples and other generations that are much more comfortable with language like this than we may be. It's not intuitive. I appreciate your confession. I would join you in that. It's not intuitively obvious. I mean, and even having been exposed to this book my whole life, I'll echo what you said. Aren't you thankful for a book like Hebrews? It really helps bring to light what God was really doing all along. I'll tell you what, this is great stuff to share with other Gentiles in the same predicament. It's like, what do I do with this book, these 66 books? Well, there's a bigger story here being told, and God has a purpose for telling it the way He does. And so even in a coffee shop, you can sit down and have a very meaningful conversation in a relatively short time to show them that big picture. I appreciate that. I think we just have about a minute or so. Any other thoughts or comments? I knew there would be no way we would cover all the details of this chapter sufficiently, so no point in starting now. Chandler.
I'm just still thinking about your point, thinking about there's one high priest, he has to sacrifice for himself first before he can go in, and how much, I mean, we're not given what those emotions were for him, but I would imagine that amount of pressure and going through the checklist that I do everything I need to do, the seriousness of where he was about to step into in the holiest of holies. And it's just making me think of Hebrews 4:16. When it says, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And his throne has always been mercy and grace,
yeah,
even in the Old Testament. But the confidence that we all have in approaching,
yes,
his throne, I think I hadn't thought about that juxtaposition of, like, what would it have been like to be that high priest?
Yeah.
And not that we should approach his throne without any, you know, humility or submission, and that it should be a lackadaisical decision, but the fact that he does give us that access in such a intimate way, as you've used that word,
yeah,
not informal in a sense, you know, there's a balance there, but that's just something I think I'll probably be chewing on for a bit of, like, the difference between how I get to approach his throne,
yeah,
versus the high priest. Not that his throne has changed, it's always been grace and mercy, but that access through Christ is incredible.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, that'll be a good comment to close the class on, because, I mean, remember what we've been saying. The writer himself calls this a letter of exhortation. So all of these hoops that the writer is jumping through has a bottom line purpose for a believer in Christ. And there are many ways to say this, but we should just be saying, wow, right? Look at what we have. And thus, I mean, he's going to do this in chapter 10 and following. Let us draw near in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean. Why would we not just jump in with all, you know, with both feet and embrace this full on? And so maybe a closing thought is, are we living in a way that demonstrates our appreciation for all of this, for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the greater sanctuary, the greater covenant, the better promises, the better sacrifice? Are we living in a way that shows our appreciation of that? All right, we'll close.